Well, good evening. Have a new face tonight. Welcome. Where did you hear from us? A San Jose person? Milpitas, that's a ways.
Much closer than where I was going.
Oh, that is closer, yeah. Well, you're very welcome. We'll do introductions around.
I'm Wendy.
Britt.
Jeffrey.
Chris. Marie. Samia.
Paul.
Ellie. And Angie. We're in the midst of this book. I don't know if you know it. Chogyam Trungpa's Training the Mind and Cultivating Loving Kindness. It's an ancient list of encouragements of how to practice, how to keep practicing, and reminding ourselves in different ways of the truth of things. Starts out with the four, what do they call the four
preliminaries?
Yes, thank you. I know, it's all a different vocabulary. But the basic vocabulary is that there are four things to remember, and if we can remember those, that actually that's enough. We've come to number 17, is it, or 18? 18. Which is about death. And it's probably the most interesting of all the things that we think about and talk about when we begin to think about our life. We have to include our death because they define each other. All opposites define each other. We can't have war without thinking of peace. It creates the other side of it. And life has another side, and that is inevitably always death. It's hard for us to keep hold of that idea. It is an idea until it happens. It's just actually one more cheap idea that we try not to cultivate too much in our culture. We'd rather go to Disneyland or do something more amusing than be too lugubrious about our end. But actually, in terms of our practice, if we aren't well aware of the other side of life, the preciousness and the worth, the basic worth of our life is lost. It's obliterated in some way. It becomes a fantasy. It isn't real unless death is factored in as an essential part of it. So the first of those four is how precious human life is. And without thinking about death, it's hard to take on the full power of the beauty and preciousness of how it is to live. Now, if you get the doctor calls you up and says, you know, you only have a few months to live, all of a sudden your life seems extremely precious. Wow. As I've said before, I had that experience and then spent a good deal of time with somebody else who had also been told that he had a very short time to live. And we spent a week at Green Gulch sewing a robe, each one of us. And we just kept marveling at how wonderful it was to be alive. Man, oh man, it really hits you when you know it's going to end. The encouragement here is to know it's going to end. Allow that knowledge to be a part of life, one's own life. As a precious thing, human life is precious, that death comes suddenly and without warning, and it always comes. And that whatever we do, whether we're good or bad or smart or stupid, that however we live is a part of everything. And that although we have something to say about how, what direction we go, there are so many causes and conditions that come together to this one place of each one of us that we can't even know how we got here. But we can know where we're going, and we have some consciousness of how to be. And this and all the various encouragements that practice brings to us helps us with this how to be. And then the last one is the inevitability of suffering. That's what stopped Shakyamuni Buddha, was realizing the inevitability of suffering for oneself and for everyone. Those are big, big subjects, all of them. And they're bottom line, all of them. And so this, when it gets to death, he explains it in terms of the Tibetan project, which is rebirth, which means that you not only prepare to die, but you prepare to in some way go on. In Zen, we don't talk about rebirth so much. Depending on the teacher, depending on the tradition and the era, Koban talked about it sometimes. We don't really know. What we do know is that we don't know one, and that it helps to be prepared for it. And so that's what this chapter is about, to allow ourselves to accept that our body is going to perish, as he says. And realize that death is always with us. It's always happening to someone else, just as birth is. And it's always just around the corner from all of us. But he says we don't have to die filled with remorse. We could die happily. And I've known a number of people who've died very beautifully and very happily, and I'm sure you all have too. It takes acceptance. So, he says the ultimate instruction on death is simply to try to rest your mind in the nature of ultimate bodhicitta, in the mind of life and death, body, mind. Form and emptiness, to rest your mind in the whole of it. Rest your mind in the nature of the mind and try to pass your breath in that way until you are actually dead. It gets to be a very interesting subject, actually. A little bit scary. But quite fascinating. So, I wonder what you all have been thinking about this week about death. If this has been your subject in some way, as you live your life with enthusiasm. Samia?
I got to visit my family and friends in Southern California a couple of weeks ago. And part of the reason I went is to visit one of my dearest friends. He's not very old, but he's not doing very well. He's about, I don't know, maybe 80. Very slim. He can barely walk, but he can. He's become a Christian Science through the years. He's an organist, so he used to play for the services. And he would sit and listen, and somehow it was interesting for him, so he became a practicing, very devout. And I was very touched by his practice and his sincerity and faith.
Yeah.
With all the not taking medication and not just dealing with the pain and everything. So make a long story short, I tried to get out of him how he does it, how he tolerates the pain and what gives him the strength to do it, because one time he told me, you know, he had fallen and I think his knee was broken and he wouldn't, I mean, he could still walk with a walker, it's like, but he doesn't know whether it's broken or not. I said, well, if your hand is broken and you know they could put it in a cast and it will heal and you can go on, would you do that? And he says, yes. It's like, so why don't you get your knee checked out? Because I think it's okay. And it's like, okay, I'll buy that. If you say it's okay, then it's okay. And having him be one of my best friends, I want to make everything okay, living in the medical world, like, we could do this, we could do that, and it will all be fine, and you don't have to die. Of course, that's in my head. But I left very touched with his sincere practice. And talking about death, I thought what it would be like for me. I mean, we could both die the same day. I'm semi-healthy, and he doesn't look extremely healthy. But I thought it would be so cool for me to write something for his funeral and tell it to him now.
Mm-hmm.
Do people do that?
Yeah.
They do?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And how is that perceived?
I think that's what happens when death gets close. We begin to tell the truth to each other. Mm-hmm. And we don't hold back anymore. We realize the time is short. And it breaks down that whatever the barrier is that keeps us from seeing what we really feel. And it's such a mercy to be able to say what you really feel, to fulfill that connection with somebody.
And then I thought how nice it would be if we always did that, whether
yes.
the other person is dying or not.
Yes, exactly.
So that's my bit about dying.
Perfect. Thank you, Samia. Yes.
Well, I had a similar experience to Samia's, in that it was a very old friend, a friend that I had known since first grade, and he passed, and the funeral was held on Wednesday, and I was asked to give the eulogy, and what you just said is so true. The hard part was keeping it to a funeral appropriateness, because I felt like I could just talk about that man for 2 hours without requiring a glass of water. It was just that easy to talk about him. And since we had that kind of relationship that was that old, we had been through everything together, mm-hmm. from digging up radishes behind second base at Llewellyn Elementary to going through puberty, all our girlfriends, mm-hmm. all the experiences that young men have, learning about music and literature, what life is all about. He happened to marry a young woman whom I had known since she was 4. So when I'm in this Catholic church up in Sonora giving the eulogy, I'm looking out at an audience in which about 85% of them knew him as a mature adult, and there was just this handful of folks who had known him mm-hmm. as long as I had. And there were 2 eulogists, myself and this other fellow. And the other fellow was a Sonoran and had known him as the Rotarian and the sommelier and the fellow around, the financial advisor for the folks in that area. But I knew somebody quite different from that. And to be able to speak from your heart is just one of the most amazing experiences. And so I got home later that day to get a phone call that my other good friend was having seizures and that he was in the hospital. So I have been with his wife and with him during this week, and it's been I guess what I'm trying to say, this extremely close a death and possibly another one. That preciousness, you know, I think of Mary Oliver's poem, and I can't remember what it's called. It might be called Praying, but I'm not sure. But in the last one, in which she talks about she wants to live a life in which she's the bride of wonder, curiosity, and she doesn't want to die saying that she came to visit. You know, it's it's been that kind of week for me where thinking about that has taken, once again, that deeper level. And I don't know, we don't know what's going on in the heads and minds of other people or what's going on in their hearts. But I know for myself that through this practice and through the fact that this is the stuff that we've been reading, it's been extremely helpful to get in touch, I think, for myself with that place I want to be. I want to be at that deepest place so that I can, whatever I offer up is the most authentic and the most truthful aspect of myself. Mm. So, anyway, that's where I've been. That's where I am. And I wanted to share that with you.
Thank you. Chris?
I'm just thinking about two very close friends that passed and the privilege of being there with them. And that Rumi poem about the door sill between the two worlds being so open and round, and people are walking back and forth, and how those people that have gone before us, it's like a light in the window somehow. Mm. Especially when you can have the kind of relationship that you just talked about, Jeff, with someone where you actually dissolve with them into that space of God or nothing else. And he dissolves into that aliveness without boundaries, without. And those dear ones passed quite a while ago, but it's so fresh in my heart.
Yeah.
Like a bell ring.
Yeah. Awesome. See the movie that Roger Ebert's left called Life Itself. And I thought Ebert's thoughts on his life and his death were just amazing. It's a really fine movie to see the courage of one person faced with just a remarkably devastating kind of disease that would so disfigure him and take away his ability to speak, and yet how amazing he is through that final chapter of his life. And he had a wonderful supporting cast, a loving wife, great friends. And it was interesting to chart the journey of his life.
Mm.
And it's a great, wonderful documentary. I highly recommend it. And it ties in quite nicely to what we're talking about right now.
Good.
Life Itself?
Life Itself is the name of the documentary.
Is it a movie?
And you can see it at Sonia's Las Gatas Theater.
Oh.
Yes, ma'am. So,
cool.
Yes.
Very nice theater. Oh.
I did not see it there. I did get into the lobby. They had sold out.
Oh.
So I did get in. I had a chance to check it out.
It's worth it. It's very nice.
Hmm. Well, you would think death would be the end of the book, but it's not. It's not at all. It goes on for quite a ways yet. It also, as far as from going from well, it goes from point to point, and then within the point it goes from bit to bit. So we've gotten to having ended that. There's one more paramita. It's gone through the paramita, starting with generosity. The death one is actually about exertion, showing the utilization of practice in one's whole life. That's how he terms this thing about death. So the point five is evaluation of mind training. So that's what we've been doing all the way through. This is all about mind training. And so this, the last of the paramitas, is prajna, or wisdom, or meditation. He conflates them in this. It's very short. There are just three of them, I think, before it goes directly to mind training. So these three are about the paramita of meditation. It says, the idea of paramita of meditation is basically that you are beginning to catch some possibility of the fever of knowledge or prajna already. Not encyclopedic knowledge, but deeper knowledge. The depth that Jeffrey's talking about. He says, if it were not the mind, if there is not the mindfulness and awareness practice of the paramita of meditation, then we have no way of protecting ourselves from the attacks of our foolishness, our jealousy and our stupidity and our anger and etc., all the kleshas, so-called. And we also have no facilities to teach others or to work for the liberation of other people, other sentient beings. The concept of meditation permeates this section of Lojong. So we come together in terms of meditation. We call it a Zen practice, and Zen is meditation. Number 19 is the first one of these, and that's the one that we'll take home and practice during the week. It's called All Dharmas Agree on One Point. He says, all teachings are basically a way of subjugating or shedding the ego. All these questions about the self. So he says, the purpose of all of the teachings are simply to overcome the ego. Otherwise, there's no purpose at all. Forget about it. Whatever sutras and scriptures or commentaries on the teachings of Buddhism you read, they should all connect with your being and be understood as ways of taming your ego. So it's about your being, your ego, my being, my ego. For each one, directly and personally. So he talks about the Hinayana version of it, which taming the ego, which means mindfulness, the discipline of mindfulness. And noticing the, what he calls the subconscious gossip that goes on in our discursive blah, blah, blah thinking all the time. And then there's the awareness of being able to cut through all of that. To somehow find a way to say, shut up already. I'm bored. In Mahayana, we begin to realize the Bodhisattva principle through practicing bodhicitta, and our concern is more with warmth and skillfulness. So we can give away each time. We have nothing to hang on to in ourselves. So those are two aspects. It's not one is better than the other. It's two different ways of both of which are essential to our being awake. These are what it means to be awake, our mindfulness and our softness and kindness. That through our meditation practice, we soften. He says, compassion develops from shunyata, or non-ground, because you have nothing to hold on to. No personal gain, no project, no ulterior motives. So in a way, this makes sense that this follows the one on death, because that's exactly the feeling that we have when we're facing someone's death or our own. We soften and give way and realize much more keenly how it is with each other. So compassion and shunyata, mindfulness, work together. It's a kind of team of the mind. The more we are aware, the more compassionate we become. Then he has this really, I have two exclamation points in the next to what he describes here as, he says, in the Hinayana, our ego gets a haircut. Its beard is shaved. In the Mahayana, the limbs of ego are cut, so there are no longer any arms and legs. We even begin to open up the torso of ego. By developing ultimate bodhicitta, we take away the heart, so that nothing exists at all. Then we try to utilize the leftover mess of cut-off arms and legs and heads and hearts, along with lots of blood. Applying the bodhisattva approach, we make use of them. We don't throw them away. We don't want to pollute our world with lots of leftover egos. Instead, we bring them onto the path of Dharma, by examining them and making use of them. This is one of the places where he's a little bit outrageous, just enough to make a point, very, very clear point. The Kadampa teachers have a saying that the shedding of ego is the scale that measures the practitioner. If you have to measure somebody, I don't know how you would do that, actually. But developing meditation and awareness is our homework for the week. Developing a very keen kind of noticing and allowing the noticing to break us down in the way that we resist others and defend ourselves.